Blog Talk Radio.
Gonna tell you a little bedtime tale, legend it will become. Burgers flying out the door, sail on. 2-for-1, no concern for the future. Living for today. Fast food bite on your way, lay it all to waste. The masses are afflicted now. Moo, mad cow, mad cow. Mad cow, mad cow, line dance song.
Hey, Sign Guy Nation, welcome to the show. QT and Sign Guy back with you again here on another Friday. Some show notes if you're looking for wrestling. Tonight, WCWO as usual in Indianapolis, Indiana. RCW in Edmonton, Alberta. PSW in Piedmont, Alabama. PWA Connecticut in Cheshire, Connecticut. AAW in Berwyn, Illinois. AMW in Stinnett, Kentucky. And PWP in Omaha, Nebraska. And also Live Lucha Libre running a benefit in Gas City, Indiana. Tomorrow night in our neck of the woods, Project 42 in Seattle, Washington, where you can find me. You have MPW in East Los Angeles, California. UIW in Buchanan, Georgia. SCPW in Oceanside, California. IPW in Valparaiso, Florida. BBPW in Miami, Florida. The AIWF in Rossville, Georgia. The NWA in Pavo, Georgia. RPW in Summit, Illinois. Fire Pro Wrestling in Maryville, Indiana. New Wave Pro Wrestling in Duggar, Indiana. TSW in Monroe City, Indiana. MEPW in Mansfield, Louisiana. SCW in Walcott, Iowa. CIW in Flint, Michigan. IWA in Sardinia, Ohio. Brew City Wrestling in Cudahy, Wisconsin. TCW in Kyleen, Texas. And the NWA in Amarillo, Texas tomorrow night. Without further ado, I am very pleased to bring to you our guest today. He is one of the more esteemed and veteran referees in our industry. Welcome to the show, Fred Richards.
It is an honor to be here. I listened to that intro with all those different towns, and I wanted to ask you, what track does the train board on? It took me back to Pennsylvania Station in Manhattan. So that was great stuff.
Lots going on. It's always good when the industry has lots going on. Gives a lot of people a chance to work.
Well, it does. Professional wrestling is a great test for the younger athletes, the middle-aged athletes, and then the people who check into the museum at night like me. You get it in your blood. It's got to be in your blood. You have to have the passion for it. It's very demanding in more ways than a few. I've been involved in it actively in the role of writer for two major magazines, referee, promoter since 1960, which makes me not old. It makes me ancient. So a lot of stories to tell, Sign Guy. So away we go. Lead on.
Absolutely, and since it is your first time with us, we'll give you our traditional first-timer question. What was it that led you into the world of pro wrestling?
Well, I am going to take you back to the days of black and white television when a man whom I was honored to know, Vince McMahon Sr., was working with men like Willie Gilsenberg, Toots Mont, and Bert Ruby, whose real last name was Rubenstein, back in 1959 on the old Channel 5, which was WABD in New York City. I was born and raised in the Bronx. The old neighborhood, as Carmine Desperto would say. I was, I guess today you guys call it channel surfing. Back then with a friction dial, it was a little more involved. And I tuned to this show, and here were these guys in the ring. And it was the late, great Nature Boy Buddy Rogers, who was pinned in the corner, and 605-pound Haystacks Calhoun ran across the ring, splashed him, broke his leg. His manager at the time was Bobby Davis. The place went wild, and I was hooked. And that's when my never-ending odyssey began. I went to my first match at the old Madison Square Garden at West 49th Street and 8th Avenue in Manhattan. That's the place where Bruno Sammartino beat Buddy Rogers in 48 seconds of May of 1963, and I was there. My late father took me. We were row one, and ringside at Madison Square Garden at that point in time cost $5. The program was 10 cents. You took the subway to get there. It was a wonderful time. It neatly finished. Historically, the last match on one of their shows was a curfew draw. It was always a tag match. The Scuffling Hillbillies, the Fabulous Kangaroos. There was some great talent. The great Mortier. You know, wrestling sign guy, as I know that you and QT realize, there's a lot of carbon copies. Buddy Rogers took it from Gorgeous George. Ric Flair took it from Buddy Rogers, the Nature Boy gimmick. So did the late good friend of mine, rest in peace, Buddy Landell. Figure four leg lock, the strut, swiping back their hair, it was all there. Now, in the days I got hooked on it, let's remember, these were the 60s. And so much of the stuff we take for granted nowadays in the way of technology, I mean, the word internet was not yet in the lexicon. So they would come down the aisle. There was no music, none whatsoever. Some of them had robes. But Rogers, who really got me hooked, would come down with a lousy white terry cloth hand towel, powder blue tights, golden blonde hair, with an arrogance about him that you could feel in the air. Now, that led a year later to my starting to write a column. One day, handwritten with an Estabrook fountain pen on loose leaf paper, I sent it to The Ring magazine, which was the oldest, most respected boxing magazine that devoted about a half a dozen pages to pro wrestling. And just for the heck of it, I sent it in, and the late Nat Fleischer, who founded Ring Magazine, gave it to his son-in-law, the late Nat Lubit, who I credit with giving me my start, and he was one of the most finest men that I ever knew. Right out of an old-time movie, he had the mentality, give the kid a shot. And he published my column, and I was stunned. I went to the newsstand, I bought it, I think it cost all of 25 cents, glossy paper. And there was my column with my name on it. Oh, my God. That began, and next thing I knew, and I had put it on my Facebook page, I got a letter from Nat with an actual press card on it. And I used to go to the old New York venues. You had St. Nicholas Arena, the great Sunnyside Garden, the Long Island Arena in Comac, the Island Garden. Whitey Carlson was the promoter. Then I went down to Washington, which is where Vince McMahon Sr.'s Capital Wrestling Corporation was headquartered. Now, they ran on a one-week tape delay. The announcer was Ray Morgan. It was a neatly choreographed 2 hours, and back in those days, most matches were 2 out of 3 falls. In addition to that, you had jobbers. The job of television was not to give the product away. The job of television was to get people to the arenas, whether it was the Philadelphia Arena, Madison Square Garden, the Boston Arena, Boston Garden, rather. There were so many of them. So they set the table, as we used to say. And with no internet, nobody could spoil it. And literally the same card ran up and down the East Coast, because at that time the territory still existed. And the formula was simple. If the champion was a heel, like in Rogers' days, they brought in the faces. Cowboy Bob Ellis, Johnny Valentine had done a face turn at that point, Greg Valentine's dad. They brought in so many, but the most interesting part, and I'll never forget this, because the offices of the Ring magazine were on the mezzanine floor of Madison Square Garden, and Capital Wrestling Corporation in New York City was located in the old Holland Hotel right off Times Square, a short walk. And Vince McMahon Sr., one of my godfathers in wrestling, was the late Arnold Golden Boy Scolin. He and his wife Betty lived in White Plains, New York, about a 25-minute drive from Manhattan. And they made me smart, and I was a kid. I mean, I was still in puberty for all practical purposes. And they told me how they found Bruno, who originally just came through, came on, passed nothing. He was having problems. He wasn't fluent in English. Vince McMahon Sr. was a genius. There were no marketing companies at that point in time. My God, we're going back to the days of pinball machines and carbon paper. And Vince went to the phone directories for the five boroughs of New York. And he started to look at them. And he saw all the names ending in vowels. And he turned and said, we need an Italian champion because he's going to draw them. Hence, they did the buildup to Bruno versus Buddy. It was 48 seconds. A guy who came to be my friend, the late Eddie Gersh, was the referee. It was perfectly done. Buddy rushed Bruno twice. Bruno got him in the bear hug. Buddy raked his eyes, and as most people who watch wrestling know, three is the magic number. And the third time Buddy came off the ropes, Bruno hoisted him into his bear hug. 48 seconds, new champion. They couldn't get the place. Al Mitchell was the ring announcer, Freddie Abatella the timekeeper. They couldn't get Madison Square Garden to stop. The Bravissimos, the Attaboys, the Viva Bruno, I mean, the place was beyond electric. That's how it was done back there. When they found Pedro Morales, the demographic had changed in Vince McMahon Sr.'s target market. And now it was Latino names that replaced the Italian names. Pedro Morales was a natural. He segued into Spanish, like Tito Santana, when he ended everything with Arriba Latino. And the people came out and they purchased tickets. There wasn't any merchandise back then. There weren't any books. There weren't any DVD with just three letters in the alphabet. They meant nothing. So they had to give the customer a reason to separate him or herself from their money. And that's how it was done. You didn't have any big TV screens in the rafters of the arena. You got into the nosebleed section and the old garden, the way it was built, I mean, you needed binoculars, and a lot of people brought them to town. I remember the first time I worked in the garden, albeit the newer one, on top of Pennsylvania Station at 34th Street and 7th Avenue. Now, I had graduated from Pace University, and we held our graduation in Madison Square Garden. But as I told my late father, who was a professor at the university, I walk up to get my diploma, I said, I like it better with a ring in it. There, the Meadowlands, I mean, New York was on fire. Then, of course, the electronic delivery of the product started. Pay-per-views, now it's online, legal or not. And I never thought I would live to see the day. They did 13 shows a year at Madison Square Garden. One of them was on a Sunday. The others were on Monday nights. And Sign Guy, QT, Ticketmaster wasn't even born then. You had to go to the box office, actually physically go to the box office to buy your tickets, and they sold out in 2 days. People would come, they'd take the subway, they'd take the ferry from Staten Island, or they'd go across the George Washington Bridge when the Meadowlands opened up. That's how hot pro wrestling was. Why? I'll give it to you in 1 7-letter word. This is my belief. Kayfabe. The minute we made the audience smart, the minute Linda McMahon stood at the Meadowlands during SummerSlam and the words sports entertainment were born, to me, because I'm a purist, that's the day the music died. When people started cheering for the heels and being mediocre or negative towards the faces, that's the day that a hernia was put on pro wrestling. Pro wrestling, being honest, never was. It never was the Olympics. It was always meant to be the theater. As I tell workers when we go back into the locker room after the match and they say, hey, Freddie, how did it look? I go to them and I would tell them, I don't give a damn how it looked. I give a damn about how it sounded. If that crowd was hot, if they were out of their seats, if they wanted to lynch the heel and they wanted to breastfeed the face, we did our job. Otherwise, it was a clown show. One of the reasons I enjoy working so much for my dear friend Yoshiyuki Nakamura at 01 in Japan is because kayfabe is religion. I remember when I went over, I flew over back in 2009, one of their anniversary shows. We were in the Zumo Hall. We had tens of thousands of people and over another million on pay-per-view. And Mr. Nakamura's son came out, and he saw one of the heels with one of the faces. Well, they took that guy in the back, read him the riot act, and Masato Tanaka and Shinjiro Otani almost beat the stuffing out of him because he was jeopardizing the business. Now you go out to some gin mill, you go out to some Roy Rogers, and everybody's in there talking like it's old home week. The illusion is gone, and our job has become that much harder. The moves that are done now, yeah, they're death-defying, they look great. But that's why these young people don't have the careers. You go back to people like George Steele, Carl Von Hesse, the great Nikolai Volkov. These guys made a career out of it, 25, 30 years, because they knew that getting hurt put them out of work. These kids dive off the ring post, they dive into the chairs, their elbows hit the guardrails. There's only so many times the doctor can put you back together before you're crippled. One of my dearest friends and a former business partner, Iron Man Tommy Cairo. I mean, my goodness, he worked so stiff in ECW. Tommy is in his mid-50s now, great guy, lives not far from me where we used to be in New Jersey. We would get together with the wives all the time. But the man walks like he lost on the battlefield. And this isn't going to go away. It's not going to fix itself. When New Jack, we took it too far. When ECW was alive, and New Jack, who I have every respect for, lives near Atlantic City, used to jump off the balcony. I said to myself, what are we going to do next when they start boring? Are we going to cut off a finger? A toe? Do we have a sacrifice? The old guys, when they knew how to get heat that kept you coming back. I'll give you a perfect example. You'll relate to this because these names are somewhat contemporary. The biggest money-making program, the biggest one in the history of the old WWF, never involved a title, a championship, never was main event at the Garden. It was Sergeant Slaughter against the Iron Sheik, and they built it up with three matches where there were DQs, time limits, a whole bunch of stuff, and they built it up to the barracks match. That's what the people paid to see. Not Hulk, who? Never heard of him. Okay? It was good, old-fashioned, blood and guts wrestling, the American flag versus the America's enemy. That was promoting. It wasn't about sex. It wasn't about some sort of deviant conduct. It was about blood and guts wrestling, the stuff I was raised on. Rarely, if ever, does anybody have the guts to do that type of thing or the ingenuity. These guys live their gimmick. When I used to cover the matches in New York for Ring Magazine and then later on Wrestling Review Magazine, the guys who worked under a hood, they came into the building in the hood. They left the building with the mask still on. They got weird looks from the police, but after a while they got to know them. The day I knew that I had been accepted was the day I got to go back and see the Golden Terror, the late Clyde Steves, without his hood on. He wore a half hood. And the day I went back there and I saw the real Clyde Steves, I knew that I was trusted. You had to earn your trust. Nobody was born into it. People I've worked with, so many of them. One of my dearest friends who I mourn was the late George the Animal Steele, because we had a gimmick whenever I worked with him. Because we rib each other. I mean, if you do some lip reading, except when we know the camera's on, we talk, we kid each other. The ribs are unmerciful. And George, before he bit into my arm, always says, I want a piece of kosher meat. And then he'd bite me. It was great stuff. The hardest thing I had to do was keep from laughing. Abdullah the Butcher, when he used to perform surgery. I have the scars on my head. Rest in peace, Jerry the Wall. When he died, I did his first match when he worked against 9-1-1 in Monmouth University in New Jersey. I go back, Homicide. I did a lot of their first matches. And it does your heart good when you see these young people go to the big promotions. Daniel Bryan, who I know is Bryan Danielson, a good, solid kid, the type of kid that if you're a father, you don't mind if your daughter brings him home. And I've seen some people who, if your daughter brings him home, you know, you better call the cops, because they're just, let's just say their conduct and their ethics aren't good. Nikolai Volkov, wonderful man, bright man, absolutely. One of the three people that my wife will allow to sit at our dinner table in our home, because she knows that the guy is straightforward, honest, and decent. All he talks about it is his daughter, the late Mike Awesome. We got to know each other in Japan when he went against Masato Tanaka. We went all over the building. I was horrified when he committed suicide. I understand what drove it to him when the diabetes got a hold of him. But all he did was talk about his kids. Dustin Rhodes, when he was going through a very messy matrimonial, we got very close. I knew his father. I had worked with his father, Dusty. But Dustin's a good kid. He just had a rocky road in divorce. Jerry the King Lawler, we had promoted a show at the old Wildwood Convention Center, an old WWF venue in Wildwood, New Jersey. And we were in the back ready to go on with the main. That's the night Jerry got the call that his now ex-wife was cleaning out his house as he was ready to go on. But Jerry was old school. Those aren't just two words out of the dictionary, gentlemen. It's an ethic. It's something, like I said before, it's religion. And Jerry went on. He worked. His heart was breaking. He was outraged. He didn't know what to do. But he went in that ring and he knew that working people dug into their wallet to pay the price of the ticket, and that he owed them product. My respect for him was off the charts, okay? So many more I can talk about. Working in Japan, the first time. Japan is my second home. People who read my Facebook page see. One of my dearest friends in the world is a very gentle man named Masahori. He's a legend for anybody who's ever worked in Japan. He befriends wrestlers. He's a decent man. He'll meet you at the airport. He'll help you, because that's just the type of guy he is. He's not a mark, as they say. He's just a regular, good old-fashioned guy. My wife met him when I finally got her to go over to Tokyo with me in 2014. But when I die, even though my body goes to science, for what it's worth, a part of my remains is going to be cremated. And Masa has promised to scatter the ashes on top of Mount Fuji. I don't know why. And then again, remarkable. Look, Japan and the United States, everything is so fluid. Meanwhile, before I was born in the 40s, the two nations tried to destroy one another. And all the times I've been there over two dozen times, not once have I seen any anti-American sentiment. We moved on. I still can't go back to Vietnam. I'm trying to deal with that. And every time I talk to myself, I say, you know what? Look at Tokyo. The people that are there now are not the same people that killed and maimed my friends. And I've got to get over it. That's a challenge for me. Working in different states, they're enjoyable. You get to see the country, our country, the United States of America, still the best country on the face of God's green earth, with all its controversies, with all its differences. When you travel like I do, you'll understand why America is America the Beautiful. You go to different states. New York State, when I started, it was like a parlor of prostitution. Everybody had to be licensed by the once infamous New York State Athletic Commission. It was so funny because you went down in the financial district, not far from what we call Ground Zero now, and you went to their offices, and you had to get an EKG. And anybody who's ever been to that office will know the name I'm about to say. There was a woman named Eva, and Eva did the physicals for the New York State Athletic Commission. And Eva had this fetish with men's nipples. and she could tweak them unbelievably. And if you said anything, she could give them a twist that would make the bravest and the baddest scream in pain. That was just her idiosyncrasy. But, of course, you brought Eva Flowers so that even if you had a heart murmur, you were as healthy as a horse. All those little things. The commissions, it was a cost of doing business. You wish them Merry Christmas in July, and curfew didn't mean anything. The railings that were supposed to be there became invisible. Money is the universal lubricant. I don't care where you go. Tokyo. As I said, Japan, my second home. I love the place. I love the people. I love the culture. Do I know how to speak Japanese? Just enough to get to Akihabara, the men's room, and the airport. But when I came back from reffing a show, now over there, wrestling is mainstream. The day I was there, the day Lou Fez died. And when I tell you this was front page news, it was front page news. It's like the old baseball player, I'm dating myself again, when Mickey Mantle passed away. I was flabbergasted to see how mainstream it was. But I went to the airport, and the one guy, as he come in, he said, "You mind if we look in your bag?" I said to myself, what am I going to do, say no, and then I become a guest of the emperor? I said, of course. All of a sudden, here comes this guy, and Japanese have very ornate uniforms. And he looks at this guy who called me over to the side, who was about, I said, Mr. Fred, two. Next thing I know, I got an escort right on the plane with no problem. You know, I've watched young men develop. One of my favorites, a young man I have boundless respect for, Steve Carino. He and I worked in Japan many times. Craig Classic, who is now promoting not far from where I'm sitting right now, in Florida, where I'm basking in 76 degrees, and my friends back in New York are still shoveling. But Craig is running Brainbuster Pro Wrestling with Johnny Vandal. I worked one of their shows recently. It was exciting. It's what I related to. It wasn't the choreographed Fed. This was good, old-fashioned, grunt-and-groan wrestling where you could get up close and personal. I love a good crowd. My gimmick is I'm very animated as a ref. I don't belong in all matches. At my age, I can't keep up with the high flyers. It would look ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. So I go in with the big guys. They love to put me in with the girls. A couple of the girls, I always make sure that I have tight underwear on because they get this perverse joy in pulling my black trousers down in the middle of the ring. It's terrific. But Craig is building it. I'm going up to work in Orlando on the 30th of March for Orlando City Wrestling, my dear friend Braden Knight. I'm flying back to New Jersey May the 12th for Lawrence Zirconium and Dog, D-A-W-G, at Clayton High School in Franklin, New Jersey. But the ones that I enjoyed the most and have the most stories to tell about were the midgets. Nobody promotes midgets anymore. Well, midgets always were novelty. Remember, going back to the days where I cut my eye teeth, wrestling was a balanced menu. It started off with the jobbers, then it got to the clown show with the midgets, then there with the girls with the tight bathing suits, nothing like you see today. I mean, everything was covered up. But when I worked the midgets, because I'm a big towering guy, we had a gimmick, a routine that we used that was terrific. One midget would cover the other. I'd get behind him, and he'd throw the guy up in the air. I'd catch him, throw him back, and on the third time, of course, I'd throw him out of the ring. The best thing they ever did to me, now I'm relatively bald, or I guess the politically correct term is follically challenged. And I came out one time. It was a city where we had never worked, down in Kentucky. It was a show that Ian Rotten had promoted. And they gave me a toupee to wear. And I'm working. And then, of course, you can connect the dots. You guys are wrestling people. At the appointed time, one of them reaches up, grabs my toupee, and now I'm chasing them all around the building. We had the place in stitches, absolute stitches. And then I had to go segue into serious mode and do Gangrel against Ian Rotten in a cage. And if you've never worked a cage in Louisville, Kentucky, you haven't worked. Because those people down there, when they say they're out for blood, it includes the referee. I've taken chair shots, gone bad. Manny Fernandez, who I love, great, great guy, tough guy, busted me open with a chair. As I said, Abby, You know, he used to have the old Schick safety razor gimmick. And while my head doesn't look as bad as his does, nobody's does, I have a few mementos. I've had fingers broken. So you know what? When people say to me, is it real? I say to them, number one, it's as real as you want it to be. And number two, if you think the blood is fake, you don't know what you're talking about. And if you really believe that anybody can jump from the ring post down to a concrete floor and not risk serious injury, then you're just plain stupid. Phil Varlese, my business partner this day, a man who I would trust with my life, he and I worked, we promoted fair, we were old school ethic. Anybody who worked for us got paid what they were told they would get paid. And if we took a hit, well, sometimes that's the way it goes when you're in business. I've worked for people where I've gotten $600, $800. I've gotten thousands of dollars for 22 minutes of work over in Tokyo. Quick sidebar here. I used to kid Steve Corino. Now, Steve was over Major League in Tokyo. I mean, he was just a fixture. Then when I came over, and it started in 2002, and I did my infamous fast count on the late Shinya Hashimoto, who was the hero over there, when we put Dan Severn over for the World Championship, they put out a T-shirt, a Mr. Fred T-shirt. And it was great because for using your likeness, you got 30%. And I always used to rib Steve that mine was selling for 45 yen more than his was. And that's something we always kid about. So my first match, let's go back to 1968. I'm in the United States Air Force waiting to ship out to Vietnam. I'm covering the local matches at that point for Wrestling Review. Lou Eskin had left the ring, and he was the editor succeeding Stan Weston prior to Bill Apter. And as Bill Apter, by the way, we found a commonality that was just shocking. His mother and my mother were raised on the same block in the Bronx, which is now the South Bronx. So when we started comparing notes about 8 or 9 years ago, it was absolutely amazing. You talk about small world. But anyway, I'm sitting at ringside in the San Angelo, Texas Coliseum, Larry Lanny country. And Don, the lawman Slatin, rest in peace, was the promoter. Dory Funk Jr., who promoted, senior, who promoted in Amarillo, was also there. And the main event was Dory Jr. against Thunderbolt Patterson. Now, they had one referee. His name was Dale Stewart. His real name was Don Slatin, Don's brother. And he took a bump the hard way. I mean, I never saw so much blood gushing from a man's head. So what are they going to do? They're up to the main, and they have no referee. So Dory Sr., who was as rough as a piece of coarse sandpaper, came over and said, "Gotcha, you've been watching this crap long enough. Get your New York ass in the ring and referee." Now, I'm in street clothes, leather-soled shoes, not good for the canvas inside the ring. I said, what the hell? If he can do it, I can do it. I just got to remember to stay out of the way. And I did. And to this day, every time I see Dory Jr., or Dunk, as everybody called him back then, he ribs me. Because I was so busy enjoying the match, I was a kid in a candy store, I almost forgot to count them out. But that was my first match. And it started from there. And I've been refereeing ever since. I don't do it near as often as I used to, because the realities of time and age take their toll. I get banged up now. It never used to hurt this bad years ago. But that's the realities, as you gentlemen will discover, as by the grace of God, you get older. And I still enjoy, I've always enjoyed the indies. I did one WrestleMania, I did 15. I did Monday Night Raw twice. I did the old WWE Sunday Night Heat. Between the Spectrum and the Nassau Coliseum, I worked for the AWA. When Jim Cornette still ran Smoky Mountain, he brought me down a couple of times. And then there's my favorite. It's my favorite because the two guys that run it, I have a sort of management role in it, but the two guys that run it are honest, they're great, and they have such a passion for this business. I'm talking about Ring Warriors, run by one of my dearest friends, Howard Brody, and Larry Lenz Brannon, who you knew as Vito DiNucci, one of the World Tag Team Champions. And we did a series of shows. I can go and I can have fun, but it takes a special show to make me walk away feeling proud of the product. And when we used to get together, this was for television only, not here. This was sold in the overseas market. And the professionalism of that promotion, we comped everybody. Admission was free. We ran it in different parts of Florida, from Tampa to Fort Lauderdale to Pompano. We filled the buildings because we were smart. We went, who likes that type of wrestling? We went around the senior citizen villages, and they brought them in on buses. So we had a loud crowd. But the taping sessions, Scott Wheeler was one of the refs, a man whom you interviewed, the great Randy Eller, a dear friend of mine, Brian Matthews. We had a great crew. Jamie Tucker, I was in charge of the referees. I've done many championship matches where the title has changed hands. It's always a thrill. It's a rush. I've done them here and overseas. I'm honored when I'm booked for something like that. I know many of the referees. Dick Kroll, who you used to see all the time, and the one who taught me, he's dead now, but he was a dear man. His name was Terry Terranova. And he refereed primarily, he was one of the steady refs in New York. And his son, Henry, went on to become a ref because that was in the days of the commission. And the way I got my license was the way they got their license. You had to go to the political clubhouse. You had to pay off. There's no sterilized word for it. And then you were told down to go downtown and get your nipples tweaked by Eva. It was a very wonderful, clean process. What were the qualifications? Many pictures of Andrew Jackson on bills that had green ink on them. And that's just the way it was done. It was the same in Maryland. The commissioner down there, the late Lou Levy, people in Pennsylvania, and New Jersey was tough. It was probably when the Athletic Control Board still regulated wrestling, it was probably the most corrupt system that I've ever seen in my life. And this was long before Chris Christie, because you had to license the ticket sellers, you had to license the ring announcers, you had to license the popcorn salesman, you had to license the guy who cleaned the men's room. Why? Because most of the licensing money went into their pockets. That's the truth of it, and I stand behind that statement. Then when Linda McMahon made her statement of sports entertainment, and the motivation there had nothing to do with the commission, it had to do with the fact that there was a 5% per capita tax. They deregulated it. That was good and it was bad, because once it was no longer regulated and you no longer had to have close to $1,000 just to open the doors, too many fly-by-night promotions that treated their workers badly, had substandard rings, substandard everything, right down to the towels in the men's room, it became a dangerous situation, and the wrestling customer as well as the workers were getting ripped off. So they went from one extreme to the other, which is never a good idea. New York still remains tough. To open the doors within the state of New York, which is still regulated, albeit a tad less, you're looking with insurance costs, bonds, and everything else, you're looking at $1,400 before you sell the first ticket. So it's tough. But this has been very good to me. I go through the promotions. Like I said, Ring Warriors, I take a great sense of personal pride, 0-1 Dog, the AWA, Smoky Mountain, and then my great friend Jeff Jarrett. When TNA was still being delivered as a weekly $9.95 pay-per-view, Jeff and I became friends over in Tokyo, and at that point I still served as vice president, was on the board of directors of a once great brand, and we were leasing the brand to them at that time when the organization was still solid and was worth something. And Jeff and I hit it off. When we worked in Japan, he liked my style, and he brought me on to TNA for several of their shows, and I was thrilled. The pay-per-view I point to, and if you ever do a search on this, I put the video up. One of the most bloody matches I ever worked in my life was Abdullah the Butcher against the one-man gang. And it was on the ill-fated, going back to the mid-90s, Heroes of Wrestling pay-per-view, direct from Biloxi, Mississippi. And if you're an ex-Marine, the mention of that town will make you shiver. But that pay-per-view, Murphy's Law was in overdrive, and whatever could go wrong did go wrong. right down to Jake the Snake using his reptile as a phallic symbol, and us standing there with close to 10 minutes of dead air. And if it hadn't been for a man I have great remembrances of, King Kong Bundy, who knew how to fill the time, we would have looked stupider than we already did. They hired announcers who had never called wrestling. They hired Randy Rosenbloom, who didn't know a turnbuckle from a mat. And it was just, it was, if Dutch Mantell hadn't been doing color commentary, I mean, my God, it would have been like listening to Vin Scully call the matches. A lot of celebrities come to the wrestling matches. That's where I first met our current president, Donald Trump. Donald would come to Madison Square Garden. This was before he hosted WrestleMania at the old Trump Plaza in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And the first time I met him, it'll never leave my mind. I mean, I saw him. I went over. I knew who he was. He still had his hair hadn't yet morphed into orange. And I walked up and I said, "Mr. Trump," and I'll never forget what he said. He said, "Cut that Mr. Trump crap." He said, "My name is Donald." And he was just a friendly guy. I mean, this was years ago when I don't even think that he had a hallucination that he would ever see the White House. But you had Jack Klugman, who used to star along with Tony Randall in The Odd Couple. You had several of the actors, the late James Gandolfini, Vince Curatello, who played Johnny Sack on The Sopranos, Edie Falco. They liked the matches. Tony Sirico. When we would run sometimes at the old Rollerama in Brooklyn, New York, Tony was much younger. He was still, because people know Tony, they know his pedigree, and he was a real legitimate bad guy at one time. And Tony used to come to the matches. What you saw in The Sopranos, that was the real Tony. That's the way he was. And these people would come in, and they were regular people, as long as you didn't, "Can I take a picture? Can I get one for my grandchild? Can I get one for my dog?" I remember meeting at WrestleMania 15, Star Trek's William Shatner. Talk about a regular guy. Pete Rose was there, the guy they still won't let into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Regular, ordinary guys when they're out of the spotlight. Fun. They talk about things. They have the same concerns, the same fears that all of us do. Seeing them in a demilitarized environment is quite different. Where is this business going? The answer is I don't know. Some people say that it's grinding to a halt. Well, I don't want to be a fatalist. I'm hoping that someone with a renewed creativity will be able to salvage it. Do I see that on the indies? Yes. I see it on the indies more than the major leagues. There are some promotions. Dog is one of them. Lawrence Zirconium, who books Dog, is a genius. He belongs in Stanford. He can help them. Howard Brody, Larry Lenz-Brannon, all you got to do is look at the available online episodes of Ring Warriors. The product speaks for itself. You have many people. Phil Varlese knows how to book a show. Craig Classic and Johnny Vandal, the show I worked, it was outstanding. They knew how to stack the card. They built from overture to crescendo. And they hit all the notes on the way up the musical scale. But somebody's got to bring it back. Okay, the boring chants are being heard more and more and more. Now, wrestling, like any business, it's a cycle. You get back to basics. You get back to grunt and groan. When they decided to get away from the longshoreman, the great-grandmothers with two teeth in her mouth, Hat Pin Mary, who was a legend at Madison Square Garden, used to stick the wrestlers in the butt with a pin. It was a badge of honor as you walked down the aisle. They paid. Are they going to pay today's prices? I don't know. But it was blood and guts wrestling. Very few bumps. If you watch the old matches, if they hit the canvas twice, it was a lot. But they didn't have to, because they understood ring psychology. They weren't afraid to sell. God almighty, these kids nowadays, some of them spring up off the mat like they just took Viagra when they've been bulldogged. Nobody wants to do submission holds anymore. The oldest gimmick in the world goes back to the Mighty Atlas, the late Morris Shapiro. Then the great Mortier used it. Ken Patera used it. It was the swinging full Nelson. with the gimmick where the referee had to pry the fingers apart, but the manager obstructed him so they could get the crowd even more enraged to build up the next show. And that's what I tell a lot of these kids before we start. When I'm asked to give a talk in the locker room, I said, okay, you did your job. You got them here. You got them here tonight. Now you go out there and give them a reason to want to pay to see you, to come to this promotion again. And if you don't do that, then you don't understand this business. This business is about anti-climax. It's about giving them a reason, like they did with Slaughter and the Iron Sheik, like they did with Buddy Rogers and Bruno Sammartino. Years ago, when they came right after WrestleMania and they used The Undertaker in it, and they had a spin-off pay-per-view Tuesday in Texas, they made the money twice because they used WrestleMania, the war to settle the score, they used it to build up another pay-per-view that was a blockbuster in revenue. That's what this is about. It's not a charity. It's not a philanthropy society. It's a business. And these young kids who just want to do spot shows and don't understand how to build a brand. You don't build a brand by wearing a stupid sequin jacket and going over and stealing the heat and getting in the camera. You build a brand by doing the blood, sweat, and tears of writing, scripting, getting the people who can portray the roles, making them loyal to your company so they're not wrestling for ABC today and XYZ tomorrow, and they protect the integrity of it. You don't steal people's money. You don't promise them the moon when you can't even get out of the sub-basement. You don't lie to them. You don't have a philosophy of just take their money. You understand that you've inherited, and that tradition is more than a word in the dictionary. Tradition is what has made this the longest-running soap opera in the history of civilization. And when you kill it and when you butcher it, at least have the integrity you want people to believe you have and put the damn thing on a shelf in a museum in some hall of fame and just go the hell away. Go the hell away. Don't swindle people. Don't steal from people. Don't lie to people. Remember what this business is. Remember what this business is. This is a tradition. It's a tradition. No matter what the three letters are, no matter what name, no matter what you name your card, war to settle the score, two girls and a guy in a phone booth, you don't need a midget who's making believe that he's abusing himself coming out of a garbage can. That's not what filled the arenas. That's not what's going to bring people back. In the Ring magazine, the preamble that was in every issue, I'll never forget the words. They're indelibly etched in my mind. This is a magazine that a father or mother, that a parent, to use the word parent in that, can leave on the table and not worry because they know it's clean. You don't have to use four-letter words. You don't have to thrust your pelvis out. You have to anger, excite, and evoke sympathy from a crowd. That's what built this industry. And when you try and destroy it with bizarre marketing, when you steal from a widow, and you make promises to her that you're going to digitize her product and you're going to make her a fortune, when you turn down offers from a major company because of your own greed, because of your stupor that might be under the influence of a controlled substance, and when you can do something like that, you deserve to be taken in a back alley and have somebody do to you what they did to Big Van Vader when he kept flirting with the Yakuza's girlfriend at the Hard Rock Cafe in Tokyo. He still has railroad tracks around his stomach from two razor blades. That's what happens when you deserve justice. If
well,
I get Fred, passionate about it, it's because this
has
been a part of my life now. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, QT has a question he wanted to ask you really quick, so if we can allow QT to
of
ask his question.
Of course we can. I'm happy to answer. Please go ahead, QT.
Thank you, Sungai. Mr. Richards, first and formally, I'd like to thank you for your military service. I
bless
myself
your heart.
Served on Governor's Island.
I sailed past it many times on my way to the Statue of Liberty in Staten Island on the ferry boats.
Yes. Yes, can you tell our Turnbuckle Turmoil listeners what you did in the Air Force?
Yes, I enlisted in the Air Force. I didn't want to go to college at that point in my life. I enlisted in the United States Air Force at 3 Whitehall Street in Lower Manhattan, right near the Governor's Island Ferry. On October 11th of 1966, I was discharged from active duty October 10th of 70 and from the inactive reserves on October 10th of 72. I was placed into the Medical Corps. That's why I was in San Angelo, Texas, because I served at Goodfellow Air Force Base. I was then cross-trained into aeromedical evacuation and air rescue at Brooks Air Force Base in San Antonio. I then served with the 5th Aeromedevac Squadron at Tan Son Nhut Air Base in Vietnam. Rest in peace, Major Ranahan. And then I came to the 58th Aeromedical Evacuation Squadron at the now-gone Rhein-Main Air Base in Germany. Quick story about the military. A friend of mine on Facebook, the great General Lawrence Thomas, we became friends because we got into political debates, which I love. And we made a bet, and my money was on Donald, and his was on Mrs. Clinton. I won. We met at a diner. He bought me lunch. That was the payoff. The most poignant moment, one of the most poignant moments of my life, is when we stood up in that diner, and like two old war horses. I was a sergeant. He was a general. And before we sat down, we just stood up. Nobody told us to do it. And we saluted. And
Wow. We
both exchanged a welcome home, brother. General Lawrence Thomas, who was the commander of the New Jersey Air National Guard. And then he did bring me to tears because he presented me with a special commander's medal. And when my wife and I are on a transatlantic cruise, I will be going back to Normandy, to the American cemetery, where his uncle was buried after the D-Day attack on Omaha Beach. And I will, with his permission, lay that medal on his uncle's grave. With a salute, choking back the tears, and thanking some guy that gave his life so that the three of us and your listeners could live today in freedom.
Wow, very nice. Very nice. Okay. Yes, give them an extra salute for me on Omaha Beach. Yes.
Depend on it. I've been there before. The pictures are on my Facebook page and my photos. And I will tell you, we just happened to be who my wife made friends with on that cruise. We were with Marion Ross, who played the mother on the old Happy Days series. And we stood there. Now, this isn't Disney World. Everything you see there is real. The craters on the beach where the bombs landed, the barbed wire, some of it is still there. You stand among those marble markers, and you see men and some women. Some are crosses, some are Jewish stars, some have names, and some are unknown. And if you aren't moved to cry, then God left something out of you.
Wow. Okay. Wow. All right. Well, Mr. Richards, West 49th and 8th Avenue is the place of the old Madison Square Garden.
Yes,
my question is, how far is this from Katz's Deli, the famous deli with the sign, "Send a salami to your boy in the army"?
Well, Katz's Deli is at the beginning of the Lower East Side, down near Houston. Not to be confused with Houston, we call it Houston. Down near Houston Street in Lower Manhattan, just around the Greenwich Village area, where my son is a producer for Warner Brothers Records, and he had an apartment there. And believe me, if you want to go to New York and you can't find something to eat, then you just don't know how to eat. As the great legendary Carmine Despirito would say, the boys in the old neighborhood would be proud.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, Fred, you mentioned to Sign Guy how Vince McMahon Sr. had the epiphany to give the title to an Italian, Bruno San Martino.
Yep.
Now, the Bronx in New York, back in the day, had many old Italian gangsters still alive. Some were not alive, but their ghosts still haunt New York. There are such names as Lucky Luciano, Anthony Strollo, Angelo DiCarlo, Frankie Scalise, Jackie DiAmico, and Don Vito Genovese. My question is, did you know of any wrestlers back in the 60s that had ties to the mob, or maybe any wrestlers that used to belong to the vicious Staten Island street gang, the Venti Lattes, the gang named after an extra large cup of coffee.
Well, I knew a couple of them, but again, I'm old school, so I keep my mouth shut. But what I will tell you is the Bronx, as we talk now, I was back there before the new year, the old area, which was just what you described, it's down to a couple of blocks around Arthur Avenue. Then you have Belmont Avenue, where Dion and the Belmonts were born. You have Cambrelling Avenue, where the great actor Chaz Palminteri was born. But it ain't what it used to be. Umberto's Clam House in the Italian section, where they have Avesta di San Gennaro, the Feast of San Gennaro. That's now owned by Armenians. They just bought the name. So many things have changed. But I'll tell you a quick story, unless we're running out of time. At one point in my life, I drove a charter bus, and I had a pickup in Queens, and I stopped to adjust the mirror. I got out of the bus. There was nobody on it, and all of a sudden, I did a double take, and it was John Gotti right by his Ravenwood Social Club on 101st Avenue, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he started laughing because he knew that I said, "Oh, my God, don't whack me," and he came over, and he shook my hand. Now, did you see the movie Goodfellas, QT?
Yes. Yes.
I lived it because the first job I had was driving for Capital Private Cabs on White Plains Road in the Bronx. And the owner was a guy named Carmine Apuzzo. Now, they loved me. We exchanged Christmas cards. He lived at 629 Wilcox Avenue in Throgs Neck. He's dead a long time. I go in the Air Force before I shipped out. They call me into the OSI, which is the Office of Special Investigations. They sit me down. They're all in civilian clothes, but you knew they were officers. They said to me, Sergeant Rubenstein, we've gone over this and that. By the way, did you know a Carmine Apuzzo? I said, sure, I worked for him. He says, well, who was he? I said, well, he was the boss. They all laughed. They said, oh, he was the boss, all right. It was then that I first found out that Carmine was one of the biggest Shylocks, one of the biggest loan sharks in the Bronx. I never knew it. But it got better. How naive was I? I would take the cab. They'd say, go see Sonny at the Chester House, which was a combination ballroom bowling alley. Sonny would give me an envelope, big fat envelope, and he gave me a $10 tip. Now, I'm talking the 60s. $10 was a lot of money back then. And I'd bring it back to the cab office, and I'd put it in this huge steel desk that had an opening in one of the drawers and had a padlock on it that could have shackled the Queen Elizabeth. And all of a sudden, one day, my father says to me, he says, did you live a sheltered life? He said, you're making collections. And I was. So help me God, if you could ever get access to my military record, it's on there. Well, they investigated me, and they found out that I was just a naive kid. I mean, those guys got me my driver's license to drive a cab. You had to be 18. They got it for me at 16. You know, there were no computers back then. You went down, you saw Rudy Ashparaz at the Motor Vehicle Bureau on Tremont Avenue. You did what you had to do, and you came out with a driver's license. And instead of being born in 1948, you were born in 1946. That's just the way it worked.
Wow, fantastic. Okay.
But
I just a few minutes left, so I want to give Mr. Richards ample time. If there's anything you would like to say to the listeners, oh, absolutely anything and everything you want, social medias, upcoming shows, merchandise, your favorite dry cleaner, anything in the world of floor is all yours.
Well, my favorite cleaner is my lovely wife of 34 years because she keeps me on the straight and narrow. First of all, I want to thank you, QT. I want to thank Sign Guy. It's guys like you that are going to keep this business alive because this is real, honest, live radio the way it should be. I want to thank all the people in all the corners of the world who have always been hospitable, even those who haven't been. It's been a hell of a trip. I may be coming around the clubhouse turn, but I'm not at the finish line yet. I want to thank the promoters, but I want to thank the wrestlers. We've all made mistakes in the ring. We're a team in there. We work it out. As I said before, I'll be in Orlando for Orlando City Wrestling on the 30th. I'll be flying up to referee the Dog Dangerous Adrenaline Wrestling Gladiators on the 12th of May in Clayton, New Jersey at the high school. I will be doing things with Brainbuster Pro Wrestling here in Florida. And I know I had a cordial invitation that I couldn't make from the great Andrew Anderson to go up to Hackensack, New Jersey, a couple of months ago. I could not make that. But pro wrestling is part of my life. It's attached to me like my toes, like my fingers, and what's left of my hair. I love it. Thank you, Nat Lubit. God rest your good soul, because you gave me my start. Thank you, Arnold Golden Boy Skolin, Gorilla Monsoon, Gino as we called him, and all the other people, Nikolai Volkov, his great manager, my friend John, and his bride, Victoria. Carmine DeSpirito, we kibitz unmercifully. You're solid people to me. And all I can say is I was blessed, and I thank God for it every time I put on my black and white striped shirt. Gentlemen, it's been an honor. It's been a pleasure. Please keep up the good work. Well done.
We'll have to have you again. Yes.
Anytime, it would be my pleasure. You guys are fantastic, because what you're doing now is what I did, albeit with a manual typewriter and a sheet of carbon paper. Keep it alive. Don't let it die.
Absolutely not. We're more than happy to have you on the show. It was a pleasure. I look very forward to the next time, and best of luck to you as you continue onward with your career, and let's keep the traditions of professional wrestling alive.
I wouldn't have it any other way. You guys stay well. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, fans, if you've got the chance to go to any of the shows where Fred Richards is going to be, definitely do so. Outstanding talent, veteran referee that has been around and knows so much. So if you're in the business and you can get on a show where he's at, I definitely would advise that as well. Learn something from him if you can. We will be back with you Sunday afternoon. We have Jimmy Jack Cash on the show. He would be outstanding. Get out there, support your local independent wrestling wherever it may be. You can catch me at Project 42 at the El Corazon Nightclub in Seattle, Washington tomorrow night, 9 p.m. bell time. Hopefully I'll see some of you there, and we'll talk to you Sunday afternoon.
Hello?